morning.
It's always nice to have audience participation. Certainly want to thank the choir and the special musicians. So much work goes into preparing for the feast and hours and hours and hours of work. Appreciate Mr. Brandenburg's enthusiasm and effort to to lead the choir. And I want to thank also, and I think all of us do, certainly all the folks, the volunteers, from Mr. Palmer on down. He doesn't know he's a volunteer, but he was, proximity sometimes gives certain responsibilities, and he happens to be the closest to this area. He ends up having the responsibilities to facilitate and coordinate the festival site. So I just want to acknowledge their work, all of the volunteers, Mr. Palmer, and I want to thank all of you for being such hospitable people here in the Kelowna Feast Site. We really appreciate talking with all of you and meeting so many of you. A couple of months ago in August, I was speaking on the phone to my son-in-law down in Idaho. It was a Friday evening. He had just gotten home from a duty that he had to perform. He was paying a bill. As we were chatting, the bill had to do with aviation. He was in the process of restoring an aircraft and had run up a fairly sizable bill. My son-in-law is a pilot. I guess you've assumed properly that by this time. He flies a Cessna Cardinal, and he's rebuilding, restoring a Cessna 195, very old aircraft. He is a rather interesting individual. He graduated from Ambassador College. He and our daughter had been married about a year when he graduated. He was hired by the work for a short period of time and then chose to seek other employment and became a member of the Rose Parade Committee, one of the youngest men ever inducted into the group. He went up the ladder in financial planning as a certified financial planner and is currently a vice president for Lincoln Financial. Now, I say all of that because he made the statement to me on the phone. He said, "I got a reality check today." He has lived in a world that you and I perhaps would not be really familiar with. He has met and he has golfed with CEOs and presidents of some of the major companies, Nike. I won't throw them all out, but he's met these people. Lincoln Financial sponsors one of the big golf tournaments every year. He is in Tiger Woods Gallery. But as he was paying this bill at the aviation mechanics shop, it was after hours. The owner of the business had stayed late. They were having a good conversation. And up the driveway, leading from the street running by the airport, came a young lady. She was a little, not bedraggled, but it was hot and she was perspiring. And it was obvious that she was in a little bit of anxiety. And she came into the office and she said, "Do you have a gas can? We ran out of gas on the freeway." It's not an uncommon thing to happen, but as the story progressed, she told of driving her friend to work. Her friend was a waitress at Denny's restaurant in Boise, Idaho. They were approximately 30 miles from Idaho or from Boise at this point in time on the freeway and out of gas. And she said, We thought we could make it to work. And I was going to sit and wait until she made her first $5 in tips, and then I would have gotten gas and we would have driven home after she got off. My son-in-law asked the owner if he had a gas can, and they had a gas can, so he and the owner's wife took this young lady and they started out of the office door, and up the driveway came the other girl. They'd had to walk. The freeway, of course, is fenced off. She had climbed over the fence, but the problem is there's a big irrigation ditch. So she had to walk, both of them. One of them walked one direction, the other walked the opposite direction to the exits, each one about a mile from this office, and had to walk all the way back in this 90 plus degree Fahrenheit weather. So they got gas, and as they were pouring the gas in the automobile, the one young lady who was the waitress, some 18 or 19 years of age, the driver was around 21 or 22 years of age. My son-in-law said he was horrified as she was helping, you know, how the gas receptacles are in automobiles with the unleaded. You have the little thing you've got to poke so that the gas will go down in the neck of the gas tank. Her arms were slashed, dozens and dozens and dozens, whether self-inflicted, whether abuse, he wasn't going to ask, but he was just struck by this. Here he was paying a very, very large bill, and here were two individuals who were living on the edge of a financial cliff. A situation that has become more and more the common thing in many, many nations around this earth, in the have nations. I would like to share some thoughts with you today about the world and about the situations we see. Now, we live in some interesting times. 2 months ago, the meltdown financially hadn't happened. Oh, it's been getting ready for decades. And decades and decades. But it was still, as Mr. Kylo said in his letter a few weeks ago, it was still, we're living great. What do we need God for? We've got all the stuff and the comforts and food and all of this. But lying out there behind the curtains, under the radar, are literally billions upon billions upon billions of people who are, if you can see my thumb and forefinger, that close to oblivion. Why? Why is the world the way it is? Turn, if you will, let's get a little good news as we go through some of this. Let's go back to the book of Isaiah. Mr. Luker was reading this early on in the feast. In Isaiah, the second chapter, I want to just touch on a couple of things. We'll probably come back to this scripture because there's a lot here. And even though you've heard it already this feast, how many of you have attended the feast at least 10 years? How many 20 years? 30 years? We won't go too much further, but I know there's some 40, and there's some of us 50-some years now keeping the feast, thankfully. God's been very generous. And we have heard these scriptures in particular maybe hundreds of times, but they never grow old. They never grow old, because we can contrast the world today with what the world tomorrow is going to be like. And God plainly says there are going to be some changes. When Christ returns to this earth, he isn't going to just simply tweak little areas and do little fine adjustments. There have to be total major changes made to the way the world operates. And I'm going to read you a couple of things, and I think you're going to be as You read this and you say, can they be serious? And yet here are the operating procedures for the major and the minor nations of this world. And then we obviously will not have to wonder why so many of these problems exist. In Isaiah, the second chapter, verse 2. I was just going to read one portion of verse 4, but I want to just set the stage. Let's think about this. Now, it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain, this is verse 2, Isaiah 2, that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains. God's government is going to be over all governments. He's going to set up his government by his laws, operating under his laws. And everybody on earth is going to be under the law of God. Now, as we know, there are those in the world today that say, oh, that old law, that mean law. Why would you ever want the law? Let's notice. The mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills over all the small governments and the small nations, and all nations shall flow to it. There isn't one government today. Oh, yeah, I'm sure that humans, and there are those who would like to think that they could put into effect a one world government. Look, for 6,000 years of humankind's history, humankind created in the image of God, they haven't been able to do it. Some of the greatest minds that have ever been, and even some who are now, and they can't do it. How can they get all of these nations to agree? Many people shall come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Eternal, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law. There have to be standards. There have to be guidelines. There have to be the rules of the road. There have to be the rules of the government. What's so wrong with that? Well, I think, as we know in the Proverbs, it says, when the righteous rule, people rejoice. When the unrighteous rule, here we are. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Eternal from Jerusalem. What we've been hearing yesterday, Mr. Erickson's sermon, and today in the sermonette, God's word is going to become the standard. I'm thankful we're being given a head start. We've been given decades of a head start in learning the instructions and how things are going to operate and how things are going to be administered. We've already been given that. It's kind of like the Bill Cosby routine when he was doing the Noah routine. Many of you will remember that. And the neighbor comes to him and says, what are you doing? And he said, you want a little hint? How long can you tread water? We're being given a lot of information prior to it being enacted. You know something a lot of people don't know, because God has given you his word and he's given you his calling. Now, verse 4, he shall judge between the nations and rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. For at least the last 200 years plus, many of the world leaders, royalty, to this very day, from that time to this very day, have been educated at some of the finest military academies in the world. How many of you ever heard of Sandhurst? The Royal Military Academy in London, or in the UK. Currently, In the royal families around this earth, there are many, 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 if not dozens, close to scores of individuals of royalty who have been educated at Sandhurst. King Abdullah of Jordan, if you want some names. The Sultan of Brunei. Ever heard of Prince William, Prince Harry? They both have been to Sandhurst. Now, they didn't graduate from Sandhurst. They graduated from other university. But they have been trained in the laws and the rules of military on how to conduct war. Pavlos, Crown Prince of Greece. In addition, in Jordan, Princess Aisha and Princess Iman have both been to Sandhurst. Leaders in Liechtenstein, Luxembourg, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Spain, Tonga, Thailand, and the United Arab Emirates have all been educated in the ways of war. Now, others have been educated around the world in other institutions of war. We have the Naval Academy in the United States at Annapolis. We have West Point, which has educated some of the many of the leading military experts and generals and officers for the Army over the decades, over the past century and a half. The Air Force Academy at Colorado Springs, Colorado. They educate people on how to conduct war. And leaders of nations have learned that as a part and a great part of their education, they need to learn how to fight and win, how to conduct warfare. Have you ever heard of a single one of them going to a university of peace? And I don't mean Berkeley. I haven't. Let me just share some information with you. And I hope you find it as astonishing as I did. I Googled laws of war. And guess what came up? International laws of war. Subscribed to by most nations on this earth today. Not all of them, as you'll hear, not all of them. The laws of war, international law, which are rules and principles regulating an armed conflict between nations. These laws are designed to minimize the destruction of life and property, to proscribe, to do against, be against, cruel treatment of non-combatants and prisoners of war, and to establish conditions under which the belligerents, I like that, it's a nice term, under which the belligerents may consult with one another to mitigate the effects of insurrections and civil wars. Established governments often recognize the belligerency of domestic opponents. We will recognize that you are belligerent to us. Oh, well, how nice. Isn't that sweet? You're belligerent, I'm belligerent. Well, no, I'm not belligerent, but we're going to do it my way. You're belligerent because you don't want to do it my way. Or you have your own ideas, neighboring nation. To mitigate the effects of insurrection and civil wars, established governments often recognize the belligerency of domestic opponents and conduct conflicts with them according to the laws of war. Okay, we're not getting along, so here are the laws that will allow us to come in and beat you up. The article went on, and this is at infoplease.com. There is no convention of the laws of war to which all major powers of the world have acceded. And many conventions provide that their term shall be inoperative if any of the belligerents is not a signatory or if an enemy commits a violation. All rules are off. If you don't subscribe to the law of war, then we're not bound by it either. If you're not a signatory to these laws, you may get a bigger stick used on you. Despite such provisions, many nations have adopted the laws of war, and the conditions of warfare have undoubtedly been ameliorated, softened, kind of slicked down a little bit, particularly in the treatment of prisoners and the consideration shown to the sick and wounded. The care of the sick and the wounded is facilitated by making medical personnel non-combatants and by clearly marking hospitals and similar installations, thus sparing them from attack. Oh, really? Some of you have been in war, and you know that for the most part, that Red Cross that's on the side of the ambulance doesn't really mean a whole lot. Because that other nation might not be a signatory to the laws of war. Conventions restricting the use of certain weapons probably have not materially mitigated the horrors of war. For the most part, only those weapons that are of limited military use, for example, poison gas, have been effectively banned. Limited military use. While efforts to prohibit militarily effective weapons, such as atomic weapons and submarine mines, have not succeeded. You cannot use poison gas, but you can drop a nuclear bomb on them. That's humane. It's inhumane to use poison gas. It's humane to drop an atomic bomb. The laws of war have had as their objective the protection of civilian populations by limiting all action to the military. Isn't that nice? No civilian is going to be hurt in war. That's what the law says. A distinction was made between combatants and non-combatants, the former being defined in terms of traditional military units. Thus, combatants must have a commander responsible for the subordinates, wear a fixed and recognizable emblem, carry arms openly, follow the laws of war. But the development of aerial bombing in World War I and of guerrilla forces dependent on civilians has tended to make all enemy territory part of the theater of operations. How can this be? We can't confine the war completely to one little area because, when you drop a bomb, it might not go where you want to drop it. Not all bombs are smart bombs. Some of them are dumb bombs. New practices and categories have yet to be worked out to protect civilian centers adequately. Really? Would have guessed, would you? Civilians in territory occupied by the enemy are, however, supposed to be entitled to certain protections. There may not be imprisonment without cause. Fines may not be levied upon a whole civilian population for individual offenses. Private property also receives the limited protection. It may not be confiscated for military use unless fair compensation is paid. Isn't this nice? We're going to come into your country and we're going to take it over and we will compensate you fair market value for everything we do. How nice. Just gives you a warm feeling all over, doesn't it? You just get warm fuzzies. This is just so nice, so gentlemanly and so courtly and, this is great. Special rules govern such actions against property as the taking of a prize at sea or in port, the confiscation of contraband, and the use of the blockade. That hasn't happened in the past couple of months, has it? In the nation of Georgia? The port was blockaded. Contraband was confiscated. The rules of war. Russia does happen to be a signatory to the laws of war. Property destroyed in the course of action against the enemy is, of course, not compensable. Places of religious, artistic, historic importance should not be attacked unless there is a military need. No direct diplomatic relations exist between belligerents. Statement of the obvious. Neutral diplomats are often given custody of property in enemy territory and entrusted with negotiations in the field of combat. Passports, safe conduct, and flags of truce permit consultations between opposing commanders. Hostilities may even be totally suspended by an armistice, which is often the prelude to surrender. The laws of war. What? Absolutely incredible. Let's contrast that with Isaiah, the 9th chapter. When the law of God goes forth out of Zion, what law will be in effect? Well, it's God's law, right? What does that law bring? Peace. Let's think about it as we go through a few scriptures here. Chapter 9, verse 6, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder. And his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace." We read in the book of Revelation that he's going to have the white robe, and on his thigh is going to be written King of Kings and Lord of Lords. He's going to have his name tag on. I'd like one of those uniforms, not King of Kings and Lord of Lords, but I hope mine and yours will have our name on it. You know, not Guess jeans or Levi's or, you know, but a nice label. Verse 7, "Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end." Peace is going to continue to grow. Under the laws of diplomacy that have been established over the years, there has come the idea under President Nixon back in the 70s, the early 70s, he modified or he took the laws of diplomacy and peace or the definitions of it, and he kind of modified it to his own thinking, and it has become a diplomatic standard for many, many nations. And his idea diplomatically of peace was and is permanent pre-hostility. In other words, if you have this boiling cauldron of belligerents, and they're always after each other, and they're at each other's throats, and they're creating all of these problems, if we can just keep a lid on it. Let's put a big steel manhole cover on this boiling cauldron, and we have peace. That makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Until you start taking it step by step in its definition, and you say, well, how can you have hostility? Oh, no, it's pre-hostility. You can still have the belligerents. You can still have all of the belligerency. You can still have all of the hotheads and the as one person was mentioning the other day, you know, those short, you know, about one card short of a deck, or, hey, you know, their oven's on, but their biscuits ain't rising. There's something wrong with them, you know. I mean, there's big-time problems with a lot of these people, you know, that stand up in the United Nations and say, you know, this nation ought to be wiped off of the face of the earth. There's something wrong with that. There really is, not just from our standpoint, but from the world's standpoint. There's something wrong with it. But see, if you can just keep a lid on that, that's peace. No, peace is the absolute absence of hostility and belligerence. And of the increase of God's government under the rulership of Jesus Christ on this earth, the increase of his government and peace are going to continue. An increase of it. It's going to start small, but it's going to grow faster than belligerency ever did. Chapter 11, we've read many times. Isaiah 11, there shall come, verse 1, there shall come forth a rod from the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might. Wouldn't it be fantastic if there were just some wisdom once in a while? If someone would take good knowledge and their experience of it, through it, by it, and say, look, here's how we can solve this problem. Wouldn't it have been nice 6,000 years ago? How far back can we go, or how far back do we want to go when we start discussing, wouldn't it be nice if somebody would have just done what was wise? Now, if we come to the short term and with the very close term, the last few weeks, why, you know, when you have a major meltdown of the economy due to absolute greed and corruption, what you do is you take some of the most corrupt and put them right back at the head of it and say, now we're going to give you $700 billion and we're going to let you solve the problem. Mr. Fox in the hen house, Mr. Bull in the china shop, here's you caused all this problem, now we're going to let you cause a bigger one. What wisdom. What amazing wisdom. And of course, you never hear politicians promising anything. Not in Canada. Spirit of wisdom, understanding, counsel, might, the spirit of knowledge, and of the fear of the eternal. There's a major, 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 major problem. There is no fear of God. There is no fear of the eternal in the leadership of the nations of this world. His delight, this rod, this king who is going to be over the government of God on this earth, is in the fear of the eternal. He'll not judge by the sight of his eyes, nor decide by the hearing of his ears. Let's see, I'm going to be out of a job in 100 days. Let's see who I can kind of line the nest with, and maybe just somehow I'll have a nice job. Let's take a crook and give him $700 billion and let him administer it. And maybe I'll get part of that. That would never occur. Surely not. Don't call me Shirley, and yes, it will happen. But with righteousness he shall judge the poor. What about the two young girls that were out of gas, driving to work, so they could make the first $5 tip and buy a gallon and a half of gas to get home? There are in the world today, due to significant ongoing conflicts, literally millions upon millions upon millions of what are now politically correctly called internally displaced persons. It's called homeless. That's not a politically correct term anymore. Internally displaced. In the Sudan, the Darfur region in particular, over 5 1/3 million people are displaced. In Colombia, in South America, right at 3 million. In Iraq, 1.7 million people. Not totally due to the war of the United States and affiliates against Iraq, but because of civil, internal, religious differences between groups, many people, millions, have fled their homes and are living elsewhere because of that. Uganda, between 1.2 and 1.7 million people. Turkey, almost 1.2 million people displaced, internally displaced. 1.1 million in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, close to 800,000 in Lebanon, 750,000 in the Ivory Coast, somewhere around 650,000 in Azerbaijan, India, 600,000, Zimbabwe, 570,000, Sri Lanka, 500,000, Bangladesh, 500,000, Kenya, 431,000, Israel, almost 400,000 displaced people. And most of these are because of continuing armed conflicts that are occurring. Bangladesh, 500,000. Kenya, 430,000. Israel, almost 420,000. I read that already. Somalia, 400,000. Syria, 305,000. Ethiopia, 280,000. Indonesia, 250,000. Georgia, 241,000. Serbia, 228,000. Russia, 190,000. Bosnia-Herzegovina, 180,000. Central African Republic, 150,000. Canada has homeless to the tune of some 200,000 to 300,000 people. The United States has 3.5 million, not due to conflicts, but due to either chronic alcoholism, drug problems, or mental problems. One headline came out just a few weeks ago that due to so many of the economic and financial problems, there are another 5 million people who face homelessness in the United States within months. That will make the United States one of the largest nations with the largest population of internally displaced peoples. Now, interestingly enough, that headline that came out about an additional 5 million people in the United States was before all of this financial meltdown began. They were the people like the two girls in the car out of gas on the freeway going to work to make $5 in tips so they can drive home. Isaiah 30. Isaiah, the 30th chapter. Let's think about what the laws of peace are going to do. Because we certainly know, and we have experienced a world that has lived under the laws of war. Now you say, well, you know, in Canada and the United States, we haven't had that much. I mean, we have military might, and we have our militaries, and we do this and we do that, but to have had it on our own soils, no. But you know what? We're going to experience exactly the same problems in our countries as have these areas where there have been ongoing conflicts. A displaced person is a displaced person, whether it's because of war, whether it's because of, well, quite frankly, when you subscribe to the laws of war, and you are a nation that goes out to conduct a just war, whatever that means, you are automatically, if you are in that mode of thinking, your government will not be thinking about those who are right on the edge. Again, when God's government is set up, what are going to be the earmarks? Righteousness, justice, wisdom. A $700 billion bailout of the very concerns that have caused the problem, does that make sense? I haven't been able to wrap my mind around that yet. I haven't seen the wisdom or righteousness. Now, for those who have been duped into believing, as so many in the United States were, that, here's the American dream. It is owed us. It is our inalienable right that we should own a home. And it's up to you, the lending agency, to give me free money. I don't need to be accountable for it. I'm not going to be responsible, but give me money. I want money. I want to buy a house that I can't afford. I want to live in a property that I can't afford. And should anything happen, I want everybody else to bail me out. Is that equity and righteousness when there are many, many millions and millions and millions and millions and millions, that's a lot of people, who have been accountable, who have worked, who have paid their bills, who have been very conscious of their responsibility and their accountability, that when they signed their name to a contract, that they were saying, you know what? I'm going to do what I say I'm going to do. Is there righteousness in that whole procedure? Not pointing a finger at any individuals. Just simply saying, is there righteousness and wisdom in that kind of purportment of hey, come on in. We'll give you this cheap money. Just come on in. You don't have to have a dime. We'll sign you right up. We'll put you right into something you can't afford. And then we're going to make it even rougher on you. Oh, they don't say that last part, do they? Chapter 30, the book of Isaiah, verse 20. And though the Lord gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet your teachers will not be moved into a corner anymore. There's coming the time when God's government is set up on this earth, and the law of God, which leads to peace and righteous, wise, just government, those laws are going to be in effect, and there are going to be those, hello folks, hello teachers, who are going to be able to say to people, look, here's what works and here's what doesn't work. We've lived it. We've been there. We lived under the governments that said, look, it's not humane to poison somebody with poison gas, but it's okay to nuke them. It's okay to drop a nuclear warhead in the middle of their city and vaporize them. That's okay. That's humane. It's quick. Well, how lovely. The Bible has a word for that. It's called brutish. Ever read the brutish individual in the old King James? Brutish. In modern parlance, it's stupid. And there's no cure for stupid, only kill. That is a quote of a very famous Japanese individual who was well known to many of us over the decades. No cure for stupid. Stupid's not a sin. But see, it's more humane. This is wise. This is just. This is righteous. It's inhumane to use poison gas, but it's humane to use a nuclear weapon. Now that really makes all the wisdom and righteousness just come to the fore, doesn't it? God's government says, and God's law of peace says, don't murder. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. And I like that because every one of us loves ourselves to one degree or another. And God says to us, you love your neighbor as you would love yourself. Do unto others, Christ said, as you would have them do unto you. With the understanding that you are doing something positive and you are doing something proactive and you're doing something good and you're doing something wise and you're doing something righteous and you're doing something just. Your eyes shall see your teachers. Your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, this is the way, walk in it. Whenever you turn to the right hand or whenever you turn to the left. You will also defile the covering of your images of silver and your ornament of molded images of gold, and you will throw them away as an unclean thing. Would that not apply to the beating of swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks? What are some of the most prized possessions in nations today? Who can build the best jet fighter that will kill the most people the quickest? And we could go on and on and on. You'll throw them away as an unclean thing, and you will say to them, get away. I don't want anything to do with you. Haven't we put a lot more trust, we as the modern descendants of Israel, have we not put more trust in our military armaments than we have in God? Isn't that idolatry? I think when you put something before God, and you place more importance on it before God, it becomes an idol. Anything that will separate you from God is an idol. And we have taken the approach in our governments around this earth of saying, hey, we just need to have a bigger bomb. A few years ago, remember the phrase, mad, mutually assured destruction? I build a bomb, he builds a bigger bomb, I'm going to build an even bigger one because I want to make sure that he understands or they understand that my bomb's bigger than their bomb. My dad's better than your dad, my mother can beat your mother up, whatever. Maybe it's the other way around. Mutually assured destruction. We'll build a bigger bomb. Where's God in the picture? Where is God in the picture? He hasn't been. Turn to James, the third chapter. We'll read a couple of scriptures here very quickly. James 3, verse 13. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, don't boast and lie against the truth. That wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. Okay, God is not the author of confusion. Satan is the author of confusion. We have just recently observed a very, very wonderful day. It's probably the one physically that we in the church do not look forward to the most. Right? The Day of Atonement. But what a fantastic picture that it points. Number one, that the causal factor of so much of the bitter envy and the fighting and the warfare and the unrighteousness and the ungodliness and the evil that exist on this earth is going to be put away. He's going to be put out of the picture. And then humankind is going to be reconciled to God. God's way of life, God's law, is then going to be the standard. And that wisdom is pure, peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality, without hypocrisy. Now, the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. God is going to make peace. And the increase of that peace is going to continue forever. Isaiah, the 25th chapter. Isaiah 25. Verse 4. We'll read down through verse 9. Isaiah 25, verse 4. For you have been a strength to the poor. There's coming a time when there won't be those two young ladies on the freeway running out of gas. There's going to come a time when all of the tens of millions of people who are now internally displaced due to ongoing conflicts, and some of them long-time ongoing conflicts, upwards of 40, 50, 60 years in our modern times. It's going to be gone. Because God's government, under the laws of peace, under the laws of God, God's government is going to righteously administer to the poor. And is going to, with justness, give them the empathy and the compassion that is needed. A strength to the needy in his distress, a refuge from the storm, a shade from the heat. For the blast of the terrible ones is as a storm against the wall. And I love this verse, this next verse 5. You will reduce the noise of aliens. Have you noticed how noisy the world is? I mean, there is just a cacophony of noise and sound. And it isn't because we're getting older, folks. It is getting noisier. Now, on the housing survey, I didn't fill one out, but is there anything anybody can do about the television? You turn it on, and it's on that you know, at the motel, it's on that set channel that comes on advertising, and it is 30 times louder than you can stand. I thought that as I grew older, I would probably grow more and more deaf and not have to, you know, it wouldn't be that much of a problem. But you know what? I just get this feeling that somehow marketing and the world has just kind of turned the volume up a little bit. I like the little signs in most of the towns here in British Columbia. Please refrain from using your air brakes. The exhaust brakes on the diesels. I mean, that just rattles your teeth. In God's government, and under God's government in the world tomorrow, says he's going to reduce the noise of the aliens. There's just not going to be all this yow-yowing and caterwauling that goes on all the time. Isn't that going to be nice? As heat in a dry place is heat in the shadow of a cloud, the song of the terrible ones will be diminished. And in this mountain, in God's government, the Lord of hosts will make for all people, not just us. We're picturing it right now. We're living it right now. Today, during this Festival of Tabernacles, but for all people, everybody under the law of God and the law of peace will have a feast of choice pieces, a feast of wines on the lees and of fat things full of marrow, of well-refined wines on the lees. And he will destroy on this mountain, in this government, under his rule and authority in his government, the surface of the covering cast over all people and the veil that is spread over all nations. Paul talks about it in 2 Corinthians 4, that veil that has come over the world because Satan put it there to hide God from humanity. It's going to be removed. He'll swallow up death forever, and the Lord God will wipe away tears from all faces. The rebuke of his people he'll take away from all the earth, for the Lord has spoken. And it will be said in that day, behold, this is our God. We have waited for him. He will save us. This is the eternal. We have waited for him. We will be glad and rejoice in his salvation. And all the nations of the earth are going to say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord. Let us go to the God of Jacob. And the word of God and the law of God are going to go out from Zion, and they're going to cover this earth as the waters cover the seas. We're living it. We're picturing it now. There's coming the time when everybody, all peoples on this earth, are going to be living under the laws of peace.